Welcome to the Smart Business Revolution Podcast, episode number 57.
Welcome to the Small Business Revolution.
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 Do you want a revolution?
You say you want a revolution?
The revolution?
It's going on right now.
Welcome to the Revolution, the Smart Business Revolution Podcast, your source for how to grow your small business without working 24/7. Now, your host for the Revolution, John Corcoran.
All right, welcome everyone. My guest on this episode is Larae Kwai. Now, Larae Kwai is a former FBI special agent and counterintelligence agent and a counterterrorism specialist. Her job was actually to find and flip foreign spies operating on U.S. soil. I mean, wow. When I first met Larae, I couldn't believe it. First of all, if you meet her in person, you'd be blown away because she looks nothing like an FBI agent. And the funny thing is, when she showed up for basic training at FBI training headquarters in Quantico, Virginia, she'd been accepted to the academy and everything, and her fellow agents in training looked at her and they thought the same thing. I mean, she was at the time in her late 20s, she was blonde, and her most recent job, this is funny, had been as a buyer in a high-end department store. Her colleagues were like, you know, had been military experts, had been in the military, had been police officers, had been high-level district attorneys and prosecutors. And here she was with this unconventional background. But the interesting thing is, it turns out she was pretty much just what the FBI needed. So after she graduated, she was in Phoenix, Arizona for a while and eventually transferred to Northern California. This was in the late 80s. And at the time, the FBI knew that the Soviet Union was actively trying to steal classified military technology in Silicon Valley. And there were a number of military defense companies that were operating out of there. So she had this huge job. Her job was to go undercover and identify and turn a known spy that they knew was operating in the region. And so she had to find this spy and then convince him to start spying for the U.S. I mean, and you thought your job was tough. I don't know how you do something like that. So before you tune out, you're probably wondering, well, what does this have to do with relationships and business? Well, as you'll discover in this interview, it turns out quite a lot. So in order to find spies operating on U.S. soil, you need to understand what motivates people, what their deeper down motivation is in a way that's even deeper than they understand. And it turns out if you want to motivate others, or if you really want to help others who are in your network, help them in a fundamental way, then you can use the same skills that Larae and other FBI agents have used to truly deeply understand what motivates people in a way deeper than they understand. So these are skills that transfer over. And today, Kwai is the author of Secrets of a Strong Mind, and she does a number of keynote speaking opportunities, working on another book. And she talks a lot about mental toughness, how to fortify your mental toughness in the world of business, based off of her years working as an FBI special agent. So I think you'll enjoy this episode. It's a really kind of unconventional one, but it's amazing the parallels that you'll see between the work that she did in the FBI undercovering spies and the way it can apply to the world of business. So enjoy this one. All right, this is John Corcoran. I'm talking with Larae Kwai, hopefully I pronounced that correctly, good, who is a former FBI special agent for 24 years, who had a really interesting job. Your job was discovering foreign spies on U.S. soil and flipping them and getting them to help the U.S. And so we're going to get into talking about that. But I want to start with this great story you tell in your book about shortly after you became an FBI special agent. You were, I think, in a mid-20s or something like that at the time, and another agent asked you to pose as his girlfriend at a barbecue at a home of a man who was suspected of being involved in organized crime in the Phoenix area. So tell us about that experience, which you use in your book, to talk about some of the issues of mental toughness, which we're going to talk about.
Thank you for having me, John. I love chatting about mental toughness. And I actually started out my book with that story because it illustrates the importance of being authentic and being who you are when times get tough and you're not sure which way to go. But I was in my mid-20s, And I was working criminal matters, and one of the guys on our squad was working undercover, and unbeknownst to me, and I really didn't know enough at that point to ask the right kinds of questions, but he just said, hey, you know, this will be an easy gig. You'll just be my arm charm for the afternoon, and it's going to be a picnic and no big deal. And in retrospect, I should have done a little bit more research on it, but I said, fine, that sounds great. And supervisor thought it was fine. So I showed up. Well, I didn't know it at the time, but this undercover agent had been somewhat suspect. The organized crime gang wasn't sure he was really who he was. And really, instead of being a federal agent, they thought he might have been maybe a competitor or from another gang that was trying to infiltrate theirs. And so I get in there, and it became immediate to me that he was on the margins. I mean, you know, he wasn't really sort of, you know, in the inner circle. But I ended up it was in Arizona, so I needed more suntan lotion. We were outside, and I'd left it in my handbag. And so I went into this room that it's like a bedroom, right? And there were a couple of women in there kind of going through things. And I mean, you know, knowing, and I had my false ID, and I'd left my creds and gun at home, so that was okay. But, you know, I assumed they would probably be a little bit suspicious. But I get in there, and then I was just followed by a couple of guys. And then they kind of closed the door. And then they just started just asking me questions about, so who are you again? And why are you here? And what is your background? And I'll tell you, it was my first undercover assignment. I was scared to death. And I just knew at that point, sort of instinctively, I needed to reach down and be as honest as I could be, because that was the only thing that was going to get me out of this. I mean, we all think, you know, these stories we can tell ourselves to be bigger, and we think we can talk our way out of a lot of things. But I was just absolutely honest with who I was. And I learned something very important that day, because no matter what label or title I wore, that didn't matter, because I was who I was. And so undercover work is really and truly about being authentic. It's about letting who you are come through so you can develop relationships. Because if you can't develop relationships with people, you're not ever going to get anywhere. And that's what recruiting spies was all about, was developing relationships and pushing forward.
And how do you develop a relationship with someone when you're pretending to be someone else? So how do you make the relationship be authentic when you're pretending to be someone else?
Exactly, when you're not even who you say you are. And partly, John, it is the name I give myself really doesn't matter. Or the title I give myself really doesn't matter. And I remember walking into a conference. There were probably 500 people, but I knew that this Russian spy who was in the United States, I knew he was there because I had information that he would be. And I spotted him. I knew what he looked like. And I saw the seat next to him was empty. So I am telling you, I was like pushing people aside to get to that seat before anybody else beat me to it. And I sat down, and I just, you know, I was just who I was, Lorraine. I gave him a different name, but it didn't matter. And we found we had a lot of things in common, one of the things we had in common was literature. He was an avid reader, and so am I. Some of these things you can't pretend. And that's why some undercover agents, we have an array of different, well, let me just go back, because when we do our undercover work, we're given a series of tests, psychological tests, to sort of give you an idea of your personality type. And so it's all about matching your personality to the personality of the individual that you're sitting across from. And so for me...
Do you mean like trying to have your personality be similar to theirs?
It's for him, I knew that he was an achiever, sort of an overachiever. And so going into that, it's coming, sort of doing a personality assessment. It's really what it is, John. It's emotional intelligence. Because emotional intelligence is not understanding not only your own personality, but the personality of the person across from you. And so it's having that curiosity enough to dig deep and observe people and observe yourself so that you're not surprised by your own emotions that surface when you're in a situation. But being curious enough about others just to understand that, you know, this is what's important to him. And so he happened to like literature. We talked about literature. He was crazy about his kids. It's just a matter of matching your personality sometimes with and appreciating the quality that another person has and trying to draw that out to develop that rapport.
So what you would do is beforehand, you do these personality profiles, learn as much as you can about these targets so that you knew those particular interests, and then you'd be prepared when you met him to talk about those things in order to build a bond with them and build up trust so that eventually you could, what?
Yes. Well, eventually the point was to build enough rapport where we could start talking about the more important issues, like how happy he was in his job, what his future plans were. Was he employed in doing something that really gave value and meaning to him? Because when it comes down to it, when we talk about recruiting a foreign spy, we talk about hiring somebody in HR, we talk about getting along with people and helping them become the best they can be. It is about what is it that you do? What is it that gives you meaning and value? And at the end of the day, that's what we're all looking for. And it really doesn't matter who we are. At the end of the day, that and particularly we get to a certain age. I mean, for a lot of people, it's sort of, you know, in their 40s, when they say, look at their life and say, wait a minute, this is not really, it's paying the bills, that's important, but it's not giving me the meaning in my life that I'm looking for.
So how do we, you and I, and anyone who's listening to this, who's engaged in business, who maybe owns their own business or wants to own their own business one day, or just as a business professional, how do they apply that meaning and value element to their lives?
It's a great question, because a lot of times when kids graduate or, you know, students graduate from college or whatever, they're told, do something you love. And I agree with that to certain point, but I love going to the beach, but I can't make a living going to the beach. And over time, that's not going to give me meaning and value. So it's marrying that. And that's where mental toughness comes in, actually. And because I truly believe that when we are doing something we truly love, that gives us value and meaning. A lot of research has been done on this, where you kind of get to the point where time doesn't matter. You kind of forget, you get absorbed in what you're doing and you enjoy it. And your brain starts giving off these chemicals, it starts producing chemicals that produce this runner's high, you know, when you're doing things that truly have meaning for you. And when we get to mental toughness, which is all part of it, because it's persevering. And if you are not doing something that truly has meaning and value to you, when you hit tough times, you know, the first thing you're going to do, you're going to quit, or you're going to try something different. And truly, a lot of us do that. We kind of like, oh, okay, well, that's not right. So I'm going to do something different. I failed there and my heart wasn't in it. And so we kind of stumble along until we finally succeed at something, right? And then that's where most of us stay, is a success, as if that is all there is to value and meaning. And I'm saying, no, that may be the right path. But you know what? To really keep stretching yourself, and that's, again, mental toughness, peak performance. Keep moving forward. Don't settle for where you succeed. Keep moving forward.
And there's I can tell you're influenced probably by these books. There are a couple of great books that anyone listening to this, I would recommend to them. It's one is Drive by Dan Pink, which
yes.
is heavily based upon the book Flow by an author yes. whose name I can't really pronounce.
Csikszentmihalyi.
Csikszentmihalyi, thank you.
Yes, he wrote the original, and that is a brilliant book. Flow is where everybody should start if they're looking to find where peak performance is for them.
Right. And the three elements in Drive are purpose, mastery, and autonomy. And I think you kind of hit on those issues there.
Yes, yeah. I did.
Yeah. So I'm kind of curious about this. You talk about authenticity and building these authentic relationships with people. And it sounds like even though you're using a different name, you're being yourself, or you're allowing most of the elements of your personality to come out, minus your identity, and developing this kind of real relationship with this person. Did you ever feel in any of these undercover operations, particularly the longer ones, did you ever feel like, a sympathy for the person that you were working with? Or did it ever get to the point where it felt like a real relationship to you? Or do you always have that, do you always keep it distant enough? Does that make sense?
No, it does. It's a great question, John. It's a question that I think your listeners are always going to be curious about. Because when I worked undercover, the only time I got in trouble with undercover work was when I wasn't who I truly am, without the veneer. So that was the only time when I kind of ran into trouble and I couldn't connect, because it's all about connecting with people. And I found that if I made an effort, I can connect with most folks. And there's something about everybody that's of interest. If you just stop focusing on yourself and get the ego out of the way and actually start looking at other people and listening to them and trying to find out more about them. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, you can't fake a relationship. You cannot fake a rapport. I never found it to be successful. I mean, I think we've all been around enough used car salesmen or pushy whatever advertisers to know that that doesn't stick. I mean, it doesn't stick. It's just like Teflon. It does not, you know, it's not Velcro. And so what we're looking for are those relationships that stick, right? And to do that, you have to build rapport. And so, yes, I absolutely found something to like about the individuals that I was working undercover against. And to be truthful, if I couldn't like them to some degree, it was never going to be as successful. And I was not the right agent to be doing that. And we might bring in somebody else. But there is a point of which you can't be totally honest with them. And that's frustrating, because you do develop friendships. And I will say this about the FBI and about the undercover operations that we deal with. We do not manipulate people. And it's not about using them and then losing them. It's not that. And in fact, I got to points in these undercover operations where I would be introducing a real agent and they suggest, you know, this is the best way for you to go forward. You need it to be safe. It's your family. I mean, whatever their issues were. I mean, because usually for them, it was about an onerous situation at home or back in the mother country or wherever it was that they were trying to extricate themselves from. And we help them with that for information. And everybody has their own motivation for doing different things. And that was the key. What motivates a person? And whether it's you or I or a small business owner or somebody, you know, in a big corporation, that's what we all need to identify in ourselves and in our team members. What motivates us?
It's really amazing the commonalities between motivating a member of your team and recruiting a foreign spy.
It is all people business. It is a people business. You're absolutely right, John. And for all of us, it was just unlocking something inside this other person that would open up possibilities for them. We want that to happen for ourselves, right? I mean, by and large, and as we move through life, different things open up different possibilities for us. And it's a matter of treating the other person with respect as well. I always thought, and I had a lot of co-agents that I never really felt that they treated the undercover target with respect, or they didn't really care about them. And if you can't do that, then you're never going to develop that relationship. And they were never successful. And then it became a matter of, okay, give me money and we'll do this. And I mean, and it's short of extortion. You know what I mean? I mean, to call a spade, it truly is. You give me this amount of information, I'll give you that much money. And so, but that's truly not how you get really good long-term recruitments and I work counterintelligence, which is foreign spy. So you might work that with a drug dealer, but not when you're really trying to help somebody change their life and move towards something that's a little bit bigger, better, and bolder than they envision for themselves.
So tell me what that moment of turning them is like when you're getting to the point where you've built the rapport over 3 or 6 months or a year, and then you're ready to have that conversation with them. It sounds like you start from a place of sympathy. You start from a place of, I want to help you. You've got this problem. I'm going to help you address it, but you need to help me. Tell me what that dialogue is like.
It's both sympathy and empathy, because it is truly the ability to put yourself in that other person's shoes and see the struggle. Understand their struggle. Because if I cannot get rid of myself long enough to really focus on them, then I'm not really going to be able to move them to the next point. And so when I see their struggle and understand what it is, I can kind of come in and say, okay, it sounds like to me, and just help them tease it out of themselves. I never recruited anybody. They recruited themselves. All I ever did was give them options, help them see what that struggle was, and provide them with options. And they made the decision, because ultimately they were the ones who had to live with what they decided to do.
And you tell the story in the book about this Russian diplomat in San Francisco. I think this was shortly after you'd been transferred to the San Francisco office, who you profiled over a long period of time. Tell us about him and his background and how you profiled him.
I believe that was Nicholas. And yes, that was a very long case. In fact, he is the one that I found in the room of 500 that I was mentioning that I ran towards and got the seat next to him. And it was a very long process. And because when you're talking about developing relationships like we are, it's not something that's normally done at a deeper level in just a few hours or even a few weeks or a few months. Because he was wary, as he well should be, of everybody he met. And he was, at that point, a KGB officer. They've now changed their name to SVR, but it's the same organization, and they've just tried to be a little bit more user-friendly, but it's still the same. And so he was wary, and he had built up, you know, as many of us do, sort of a wall around himself. And he was in a kind of in a tight spot, because he had a child at home. Back, I think he had one in Russia and he had one here, two children all together. But he always wanted to be kind of an artist. And so that was the thing with Nicholas. He actually was a real kind of buff guy. And I had another agent be my boyfriend, because I never wanted there to be, you know, any kind of, I wanted to be purely platonic, you know what I mean? And so I always had, you know, boyfriends or whatever around. And so we would go for hikes, and he would like draw, and he would send these photos to his son or give them to his son. And he wanted to be kind of an illustrator. Oh, he was a spy. I mean, we're talking about one end of the spectrum to the other, right? But you know what? I could sympathize with him, because I was an FBI agent and I've always wanted to write. And so, you know, economics and pressure of making a living, they all cloud sometimes with that, you know, what we really want to do in life, what that real passion is. And so I had to make a living. And so did he. And I always told myself, someday I wanted to write. I wanted to allow that creative part of me to come out. And so we had that bond. And that was an amazing bond that we couldn't forge. You couldn't pretend was there. But I was with who I really am. I was Larae Kwai with him, not my undercover name. And I mean, you know, I'm just saying myself with him, not I was representing myself as somebody else. But, and so those were some of the things that we could start sharing, and with honesty and deeper levels. And we could both be vulnerable, and I was vulnerable with him as well. I mean, you know, I was kind of explaining what was going on with me, but you know what the FBI does, and is that we never, and what you cannot ever do is break trust. So I will never be known to Nicholas as an FBI agent. I then in turn introduced him to somebody in true name. But and that's just not, because you can't do that. You can't say, I've been your friend for 5 years, but guess what? All that has been, you know, that's not really been my name, and that's not really what I really do. And so I introduced him to somebody else who was FBI. And then I moved. And so I'm no longer in contact with Nicholas.
Hmm. Is he still here or no? He, well, I guess he is in the U.S., right?
You know what? Read the book. I wouldn't be able to really go any further with that, but Nicholas made some good choices for him.
Yeah.
And, without damaging,
I'm going to say I'm pretty clear. He's probably here somewhere.
He's much happier than he was doing something that he really enjoys doing.
Yeah, is what an interesting story that is. I have to ask, and I hate it sometimes when people ask these types of questions based on pop culture. I'm sure you get them all the time. But a show that I love right now, I don't know if you've watched it, is The Americans, which is on FX, and it's set in the early 1980s. Actually, Dan Pink turned me on to it. He mentioned it in an email or something like that. And set in the early 1980s, and it's Russian spies undercover in the U.S. in the Washington, D.C. area in the early 1980s. And one of the interesting things is they're always putting on these different disguises and pretending to be someone else and using different accents and different names and wigs and all this kind of stuff. And that's certainly the popular culture perception is that you need to do that. But you actually tell a story in the book about an agent who tried to have a Southern accent one time, and that just kind of ruined the veneer there.
You know, John, those stories, and I'm not familiar with The Americans. I've heard of it, but I've not ever watched it. But there's some great shows out there. Blacklist is amazing, but it's so far from reality of what the FBI is really like. The Mentalist is now about the FBI. Again, that's so far removed from anything that's remotely, but both are very entertaining shows. I haven't seen this, so I'll have to check up on it. So yes, by and large, this is my general philosophy. You can't show up looking like who you really are and trying to develop a relationship with somebody, just stay home. I mean, what will work and what I have done is if you're working surveillance and you don't want to be recognized. And so I might put on, you know, I might just do something totally different and try to disguise myself so I could work surveillance so I'm not spotted. But when it comes meeting people face to face, if you can't be who you are, just stay home. You're not going to fool anybody. It's great drama, though. Great drama for TV. Love it for TV. And Sherlock Holmes was one of my favorites. Sherlock is always disguising his looks, you know. And there's some amazing things you can do with, you know, but it is sort of fantasy.
I want to ask a little bit about some of the things and tactics and tools that you used in order to be more courageous, which is one of the courage. That's one of the things you write about in the book. And one idea I saw you write about, this was on your blog actually, was if you have a fear of something, to give it a name and the power of doing that. So if you're afraid of public speaking, call it Uncle Eddie or Harry or Mildred or something like that. Can you explain how that works?
You know, there's so much amazing research that's being done, John, on how we can use our brain, our mental powers, to better serve ourselves instead of not serving ourselves, which is often the case. And I think mental toughness is just reaching out and saying, you know what, I am taking control of this. So when you have a fear of something, just give it a name. Just first of all, there's a couple of steps. First of all, acknowledge it, because if you try to suppress it, it's not going to work. And the brain is smarter than that. And that's a lot of us are taught at a very early age, particularly in Christian environments, don't think bad things or don't say that or don't whatever. But, and I'm not saying you should, but you have to acknowledge it. You have to acknowledge the positive and the negative emotions, because the negative are there, whether you like it or not. But this is how you control it. You just give it a name. And you can call it. You can call it whatever you want to call it, but acknowledge it and label it for what it is, but do not engage in conversation about it. And there has been a lot of research on that as well. And I'm trying to think, I don't think Csikszentmihalyi, who wrote Flow, wrote about this. I cannot remember who has right now. But the point being, if you enter discussion about it, it actually activates the brain. So the key is to not engage in conversation about it, but to label it, to identify it, and then to move on. And so, because it's so important that you get it out there where you can see it instead of trying to suppress it.
Interesting. You also write about confidence, which I think is something that everyone struggles with from time to time, how to be confident, particularly when you're working your way up the ladder as your business is growing or you're being promoted to a higher level, how we really maintain that sense of confidence. And that was something that you wrote about you struggled with when you first showed up for basic training at Quantico, the FBI training headquarters. Can you tell us about that experience?
I can. And I tell you, I was, when I got my degree in business, I was a buyer at a department store. And so my first day, but I hated it. I just wasn't my thing. So I entered the FBI, first day at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia.
I love, by the way, how that's like the backup plan. You're like, it doesn't work out as a buyer at a department store. So you're like, I'll just join the FBI.
Well, it was, you know, I just felt it was the right thing for me to do, and talk about finding your passion and knowing that there's something more to life than selling a woman a striped blouse instead of a polka dot blouse. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
There had to be more to life than that. And so I wanted, so that this, the FBI was what came to my mind. So I showed up that day, and I mean, it is a pretty macho organization. I'm not saying they're touchy-feely. I will say emotional intelligence is the backbone of probably almost everything we do, because relationships are the backbone of what we do. It is about developing sources and about, you know, recruiting people or whatever. But that day I walk in and there's 42 people, and I think there were 6 women in my class. And so the guy in front of me stands up and he said, you know, I'm with the U.S. forces. I just got back from this dangerous mission in Northern Africa. And the guy over here stands up and said, you know, I was a top prosecutor in New York, and we went after those mob families. We were successful. Guy over here says, I was a state trooper in New Jersey, and I got shot at, you know, survived all these shootouts. So then I stand up and I say, oh, well, I was a buyer at a fancy department store. I mean, everybody just kind of looked to get a look at the fluff ball that had accidentally gotten into the FBI Academy. And so I did have confidence issues from the very, very beginning. But what was really hard for me, John, was that while I did great in firearms, and while I did great in the law, legal part of it, because basically 3 components, it was the physical fitness that was the hardest for me. And the thing is, when you're out there running, you're only as fast as the slowest runner as a team. And guess who was the slowest runner? And so I felt like a weak link from the very get-go. And I will say this, that the failures that I experienced at that point in my life were the most important failures of my life, because they brought me to this point of where I had to understand some very important things about myself. First of all, was this where I wanted to go? Was this that job, that career that was going to have value and meaning for me? And the answer was yes. Was I able to move beyond success or being able to do a push-up to do, I think we had to do either 45 or 50 push-ups. I had to continually stretch myself so that every day I hit that discomfort zone. I hit that zone of which I felt I couldn't go anymore. And then the next day I moved right back into that discomfort zone, because that was the way I was going to build the confidence and the talent and skill needed to keep moving forward. If I stayed where I was, where it was comfortable, I could have stayed in the department store. I'm just saying, to get where I wanted to go, I had to push myself, and that built confidence. And as almost paradoxical as that sounds, when you move into that discomfort zone and you move through it, you build confidence in yourself. I mean, it creates an I can attitude. Not a I hope I can, but an I can attitude. And so this is the thing. Each one of us should have a little petri dish, a little area of which we're not succeeding. Because only by moving there, almost on a daily basis, can we really keep moving forward and improving ourselves and moving toward peak performance. And when we do, we get that confidence. Because what happens when we fail, then our confidence just, we lose it. But we have to get more confidence with failing. And when we do, it's not the end of the world. It's simply a challenge to keep moving forward. But there's something very important here. Our reach should not exceed our grasp by more than 4%. And there's been research on that as well. 4% over your present skill level is what you really need in order to keep moving toward peak performance. Anything more than that will probably discourage you. Anything less than that is not going to really move you from where you are right now.
And that's an interesting discussion, which brings us into our next topic, which is resilience, which is really talking about the larger setbacks in life, not just the 4%, but the bigger setbacks in life, which so many of us face going throughout our career, throughout our lives. So what advice do you have for people for being resilient, make yourself more resilient?
Resilience is really key. And it's just getting up when you know you can't. And having that persistence and willpower. Now, willpower is it's something that comes in doses. You can't run a race on willpower. You can do that last sprint on willpower, but it's that extra oomph you need for triumph. So persistence, resilience is what you need to really prepare for that race and get to that last mile before willpower kicks in. I've had quite a bit of experience with resilience and the need for resilience. And the way, because roadblocks just happen. I mean, we can't predict them. You know, I wish we could, but we can't. And no matter where we are in life or what age we are, we're always going to come up against something, or chances are. And for me, and what I found in looking at an obstacle in the road is a little bit like looking at it as an investigation, as a case. Because so often we look at an obstacle that's in our way, and we've got this vision over here, we've got this goal, and we're hit. We get stuck, simply a roadblock or something happens. And we tend to look at it in the same way. And so it's like keep beating your head against a wall until you get a bloody forehead, thinking, when is this wall going to give way? Instead, when I got a case or looked at an investigation, you kind of do this 360. You don't just look at it. You might try that and see what it looks like. That didn't work. And you keep moving and you keep looking. You don't stay static. You don't look at it the same way. You keep mobile and flexible and agile. And I think for resilience, that's the key. And so easily we get into this fixed way of thinking that it has to be like this instead of, okay, that didn't work. Let's just try something totally new and different. And that's where a flexible and agile mind is so essential.
Great. So final question I want to ask you about is just looking back on your career, everything you've achieved up until this point, what role did relationships play for you working your way up through the ranks, maybe in terms of a mentor or other special agents that you worked with who were peers to you? What role did they play in your success?
Well, you know, there's been several people, several relationships. I'll start with one. That was my grandmother. She was a tough old, I grew up on a cattle ranch in the middle of Wyoming. And I mean, she was the kind of woman who, she was a crack shot with a shotgun, and she had ammo on her Christmas list. I mean, I'm saying my grandmother, when I came up and I started whining and complaining or blaming somebody, she'd just say, suck it up. And she meant it.
And then she'd cock her shotgun, I guess.
Exactly. You don't argue with a grandmother's a crack shot with a 30-06. And so I started early and in relying upon myself. And I say that to parents. You know, it's so tempting to protect our children. I mean, we want to, you know, make life perfect for them, but we can't because life isn't perfect. So equip them. I mean, 6 years old, my grandmother was telling me to suck it up. So, I mean, it doesn't start too soon. But, I mean, there was love there. I don't mean to imply that there wasn't, but it was, you know, she suffered no fools. And so, but then to move on, I would say, and I know that there's a lot, and being a female in the FBI, I really didn't have an option of having a female mentor because there just weren't any. And in fact, a lot of the guys didn't want females in the FBI. And so I remember the guy I was sitting with in my first office, which was Phoenix, coming in. We were co-assigned a case, and he went into my supervisor and he said, do I have to work with her? And my supervisor said, well, you're going to have to get used to them because they're here to stay, meaning women, right? And so he's now passed, but he was my first mentor, and he was a great mentor because he knew his job, and he didn't take the time to spoon feed it to me. I had to pick it up pretty quickly. But I remember there was a little boy who was kidnapped. Or he went missing. We didn't know what happened to him. And so I went with this guy, and we went in and we talked to the father, and he said, and we kept saying, do you have any idea of who could have done this? Who could have taken your little boy? And he said, no, 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 absolutely not. No. And so we got outside, and I said to my case agent, and I said, man, he doesn't know, does he? And he said, no, just the opposite. When anybody uses the word no like that so many times and with so much repetition, he's hiding something. And sure enough, but those were the kinds of things he taught me through body language and how to be a good investigator. He'd turn over in his grave if he thought I referred to him as a mentor, because we never so much as had a cup of coffee together. But I listened and I learned from him. So, and I know that there are a lot of other examples that people have where people take them by the hand and they teach them these things. So I didn't have that, but I still learned. And my advice there is that, you know, relationships are where you find them. And if you look, you'll find them and you can learn from other people. And that is really, that's the magic, I think, of reaching out and this thing that we call community, because there's always something you can learn from somebody.
Yeah, well, I think particularly when it comes to mentors, it doesn't need to be a formal relationship. It could be just someone who you take out to lunch from time to time and you know, pick their brain.
Well, absolutely. And as long as you learn from them and you know that they have something to offer you and that you need to learn. And I just never really cared that much whether or not it was a formal relationship or not. I knew one thing. I wanted to be a good FBI agent. So I learned, I picked the best. I picked people who were good agents, who were successful, who could teach me something. And that's how I picked my mentors.
And that's such a great point. So thank you so much, Lorraine. This has been fascinating. So tell everyone where they can learn more about you.
I'd love to have your listeners come and visit me on my website, which is www.larraequai.com. And my name is spelled LARAEQUY. On the website, there's a free mental toughness mini course where you could sort of get an idea of what mental toughness is really about. My book, Secrets of a Strong Mind, is available on Amazon. And then I am just in the next couple of months, my second book will be out. And that is called 52 Tips, Mental Toughness for Women Leaders. So I'd love to hear from each and every one of you.
Great. All right. Thank you so much, Lorraine.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening to the Smart Business Revolution podcast with John Corcoran. Find out more at smartbusinessrevolution.com. And while you're there, sign up for our email list and join the revolution.
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 And be listening for the next episode of the Smart Business Revolution podcast.